This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome again to Encounter here on the Voice of America. I'm Doug Bernard, sitting in this week for Carol Castiel. Today, the battle for the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Will it expand trade and open new markets across the Pacific Basin? Or is it a bait and switch that will chip away at labor law and environmental protections? Or just maybe a bit of both. Well, last week, President Barack Obama was hard at work canvassing members of Congress to give him so-called fast-track authority to negotiate a sweeping trade agreement that could reshape global trade and economics for decades to come. And in a twist on how things have worked in Washington recently, Mr. Obama's main support came from congressional Republicans. It's largely members of his own party that balked, handing Mr. Obama a setback, although that may just be temporary. Now, for those of a certain age, the current debate about the TPP has a back-to-the-future quality to it. All the way back in 1993, another Democratic president, Bill Clinton, was struggling with members of his own party to pass the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA. Now, like TPP, support and opposition to NAFTA cut across party lines and also led to one of the most infamous political predictions of the decade, Ross Perot's threatened giant sucking sound of Mexico swallowing up U.S. jobs. Well, given that the TPP could eventually affect more than 50% of the world population, depending who participates, we wanted to take time this week to explore just what it is, what it might do, and also explore the broader issue of free trade. Well, it's a pleasure to welcome our two guests joining us this week, Sarah Anderson with the Institute for Policy Studies. Ms. Anderson directs the Global Economy Project. She also serves on the Investment Subcommittee at the U.S. State Department's Advisory Committee on International Economic Policy. That is a mouthful. Her latest book is titled The Field Guide of the Global Economy. That's published by New Press. Thank you so much, Sarah Anderson, for joining us.
Great to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
It's also a pleasure to welcome Brian Riley. He's the J. Van Andel Senior Policy Analyst in Trade Policy at the Heritage Foundation's Center for Trade and Economics. And lucky for us, before joining Heritage, Mr. Riley actually worked for the passage of NAFTA in the early 90s and has been an advocate for free trade since. Mr. Riley, thank you for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you.
Well, let's begin by taking a look at what this TPP actually is. And Sarah Anderson, I think part of the problem here is that members of the public, perhaps even maybe members of Congress, really can't speak much about what's actually in it.
That's exactly right. There are a few cleared advisors who get to go down in the basement and read the 700-page draft of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, but people like you and I aren't allowed to do that. And so what we can do to get a sense of what might be in the deal is to look at past models. And it's interesting you bring up the North American Free Trade Agreement, because that's been more or less largely the blueprint for U.S. trade agreements ever since. I'm also one of those people of a certain age who was involved with the NAFTA debate back then. And so what we're going to see in this Trans-Pacific Partnership, I think, is not a whole lot about the traditional trade issues having to do with eliminating tariffs on goods that cross borders. What we'll see is a lot more about other issues, intellectual property rights, investment, financial services, sanitary standards, and so forth.
Really encompassing them.
Exactly. And with the main goal being to put limits on the role of government in those areas, to restrict the ability to regulate corporate activities, with the idea that by lifting regulations, allowing more unfettered competition, you'll have a more efficient global economy. My position would be that's something to be really concerned about, that we do need responsible regulation. What we know also will be in this agreement is the power going to foreign investors to file claims for compensation against governments for actions that diminish the value of their investment. And that can include a wide range of public interest regulations covering environmental, public health, and so forth. And so it really is a deregulatory push more than it is a trade agenda.
Here's how long ago that debate was in 1993. That's when the first Jurassic Park movie actually came out.
Brian, very little has changed changed, huh?
Right. Brian Riley, I'm curious your thoughts about what you can tell us that you know, your knowledge of the TPP. But first, if I can ask you, is it traditional when international agreements like these are being put together that they occur under something of a cloak of secrecy so that the public or maybe even some members of Congress can't really speak definitively to what's in it?
That's exactly how trade negotiations typically have been done in the United States. And then what happens once the agreement is wrapped up, the agreement becomes public. Congress gets a number of days to look at it. The public gets plenty of time to look at it. And at that point, we've decided, oh, is this a good agreement? We should pass it. Or is it a bad idea? We should not pass it. So when you hear people talk about trade promotion authority, I often see them skipping ahead and predicting what might in the TPP agreement and thinking, well, if we want to kill the agreement, what we should do is kill the ability to negotiate the agreement. And I think there could be more transparency. That would be helpful. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I find so interesting about the TPP, I hear people who have the exact opposite concern. They think President Obama is going to do what he's promised to do is to negotiate the most progressive trade deal in history. It's going to include minimum wage guidelines for the first time in history. It's going to cause an increase in regulation and not a decrease in regulation. I'm not predicting that would happen. I don't know what the outcome is going to be. But I see a lot of people just either assuming best case scenario, worst case scenario, when really I think the more interesting thing is looking at what Trade Promotion Authority does and how to get to a conclusion that will be in the best interests of the United States.
Brian Riley with the Heritage Foundation's Center for Trade and Economics, also joining us this half hour. Sarah Anderson with the Institute for Policy Studies. We're taking a look at the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the debate that's going on behind it, and also the broader issue of free trade. Okay, so there's always winners and losers, I have to think, in free trade agreements, whether it's NAFTA or some of the bilateral agreements. First to you, Brian Riley, when you think, generally speaking, of winners and losers, are there general categories, or is each free trade agreement unique?
Well, I think there's some general principles. Here at Heritage, we publish an index of economic freedom every year, and it shows countries which have more economic freedom, and specifically which have more free trade, tend to be much more prosperous than those that have low trade barriers. So if you look at countries like Hong Kong, New Zealand, Australia, Canada, with low trade barriers, they're more prosperous than countries which restrict free trade. And what I mean by free trade is when somebody earns a paycheck, they get to decide how to spend the money. And you look at NAFTA, which has been so controversial, but since NAFTA was passed, global tariffs have declined by about 50%. Now, NAFTA was just three countries, but you had other countries then say, uh-oh, we better cut our own trade deals. So it's been a success in that regard. And in the United States, manufacturing output has increased by about 50% since NAFTA was passed. So I think Ross Perot's been proven wrong.
Sarah Anderson, again, looking at whether it's NAFTA or some of these other bilateral agreements that the United States has negotiated, do you see general categories of, quote, winners and losers, or is it really more difficult in analysis than that?
Well, I would say that I think the manufacturing sector has been hardest hit. Yes, manufacturing output might have increased, but we've lost 5 million U.S. manufacturing jobs since the passage of NAFTA. But I guess the way I would generally categorize it is that these agreements are designed to be in the interest of large corporations to allow them to move their products, their money, their production facilities around the globe more easily with less regulation. And what that does to me is it pits workers and communities around the globe against each other as companies seek the lowest wages, the lowest standards. So I see that division. I don't see it as a division between U.S. workers against workers in Japan or elsewhere. I think it's in the interests of large global corporations.
Brian Riley, generally speaking, and apologies if I do damage, but generally speaking, corporations win and workers lose?
I don't think that's the case at all. If you look in the United States, somebody who wants to go buy a new T-shirt or a new pair of shoes has to pay double-digit tariffs as a result of U.S. trade barriers. So we ought to be working to reduce those trade barriers in the United States. And when we lower barriers in other countries, that creates new opportunities for us to do business abroad as well. And the idea that these are some kind of special agreement to protect corporations, I just go back to the U.S. Constitution, which says as a principle that as an American, you have a right to not have your property taken without seeking compensation. And that's almost word for word the text that has been in our trade agreements, which is if you have an investment in another country and that investment is stolen or expropriated, you don't have to rely on their court system to hope you'll get some compensation, but you can go to a non-biased arbitration panel representing all countries to have a more neutral assessment. So that's all that that's about.
Yeah, if it was just about taking physical property from foreign investors without compensation, I wouldn't have much problem with it. In fact, there is a case a bit like that against Chile, where during the dictatorship, they took a building from a left-wing newspaper. And I don't think that's right. I think the investor should get compensation. What bothers me are the dozens, if not hundreds, of cases that have been filed related to environmental regulations, public health regulations. Think back to the first case that was filed under NAFTA by the U.S. company Ethyl over a public health regulation in Canada. In the face of that lawsuit, Canada repealed that regulation. So we're not talking here about just direct expropriation of physical property. We're talking about companies being able to sue over public interest regulations that might diminish the value of their investment, but that some lawmaker or some regulator out there thought was in the best interest of the public.
You're listening to Encounter here on The Voice of America. Our guests this hour, Brian Riley, the J. Van Andel Senior Policy Analyst in Trade Policy at the Heritage Foundation's Center for Trade and Economics, and Sarah Anderson with the Institute for Policy Studies, where she directs the Global Economy Project. We're taking a deeper look today at the Trans-Pacific Partnership. That's a trade agreement that could reshape international trade for decades, and also the broader issues of free trade in general. This quick reminder that Encounter's podcast is available for free on iTunes, on our website, voanews.com/encounter, and you can also follow us on Twitter. That's at Carol Castiel, VOA, and connect with us on Facebook. Let's take a look at who is and who isn't participating potentially in this TPP. So the nations that I understand that are in negotiations: Australia, Brunei, Canada, Chile, Japan, Malaysia, Mexico, New Zealand, Peru, Singapore, the United States, and Vietnam. So you can see clearly ringing right around the Pacific Basin. Notably not on this list, several nations. The first one is China. Brian Riley, why is China not on this list?
Well, it's interesting. This was a really small trade deal initially that kept growing. The United States wasn't an initial member. We joined on. Canada and Mexico joined on. It's been being negotiated for nearly a decade, even though the president does not currently have formal trade negotiating authority. We've been negotiating the agreement. And the newest entrant has been Japan. And one of the issues that's happened is whenever somebody new has signed on, especially a large economy like Japan, it's made it more complicated to hash out an agreement for all the countries. Mm-hmm. One of the goals has been for the United States to have this not to be a trade block, which excludes other countries, but something that would attract other countries to sign on in the future and that would encourage more economic liberalization by China and other countries in the region. It remains to be seen whether we'll be able to achieve that goal, though.
Of course, also not on the list, Russia, in addition to some other smaller nations. Sarah Anderson, do you see a role for these free trade agreements to perhaps nudge other nations into perhaps comporting more with a general set of international standards, or at least those standards as seen from the United States perspective?
Well, the most common talking point, I think, coming out of the administration and other proponents of the Trans-Pacific Partnership right now is that if this thing doesn't pass, the U.S. won't be writing the rules of the global economy. China will. I think if they really want to distinguish themselves from China in this global arena, they would be pushing an agenda that is pro-labor rights, pro-environment, pro-democracy. That is not what the Trans-Pacific Partnership is about.
Brian Riley, looking back to your experience, both of you have experience with NAFTA. What worked in selling that agreement? Because I recall, as a young journalist, even covering it back then, this was not a done deal by any means.
I remember the debate between Al Gore and Ross Perot on Larry King, and you can actually look up the debate on YouTube. And it starts with Al Gore presenting Mr. Perot with a picture of Congressman and Senator Smoot and Hawley, Republicans who authored disastrous Smoot-Hawley tariff bill in 1930, which exacerbated the U.S. depression, caused other countries to enact trade barriers restricting U.S. products. Did it cause World War II? No, but it's the exact kind of thing that contributes to international retaliation, bad economic feelings, which can escalate into military problems. The other thing is that was unique at the time, it was an agreement that had been negotiated by Republicans, concluded by a Democrat. So there was a lot of bipartisan support.
Right.
There was bipartisan opposition, too, as you noted. And the politics here are just so wild to see a Democrat who, let's face it, most Republicans or conservatives don't have a lot of faith in, relying on Republicans to pass a trade bill that Nancy Pelosi and Bernie Sanders and others think is awful.
Let's take this apart a little bit, and I'm just going to mention for the record, we started looking for guests to speak sort of in favor of the TPP a good week ago, and we just had the darndest time finding people. It seems like a lot of the supporters after last week's vote seem to go a little bit underground. Sarah Anderson, we have several acronyms on the table here. We have TPP, we have this assistance program. Yeah. Last week in Congress, there was a vote in the House. What specifically was being voted on, and what got voted down?
Okay, I will try to sum it up, but I have to say, in my more than 20 years in Washington, I don't know if I've seen anything this complicated, and I completely agree with Brian. It was a wild scene down there.
Yeah.
So what happened was the Senate passed a bill that had both the fast-track trade promotion authority and this worker assistance program called Transitional Adjustment Assistance, which gives some training funds to workers who lose their jobs as a result of trade agreements. But the real, you know, core issue here was the fast track, which allows the executive branch to conclude new trade agreements and push them through Congress with limited time for debate and no chance for amendment. So the Senate passed those as one bill.
Mm-hmm.
Then over on the House side, they decided to split them up, but with the understanding that if either piece didn't pass, the whole thing would go down, the whole package would go down. So first they brought up the Transitional Adjustment Assistance, and it went down hard. More than 300
right.
votes against it. That meant that Fast Track couldn't pass, but to show momentum, they brought it up for a vote anyway, and it did get a slim majority, 219 votes, whereas 217 would be needed. So now, who knows what's going to happen next?
Right.
There's all kinds of jockeying going on.
Well, as we speak, as we're taping this week, there are negotiations that are being reported between the Senate and the House and the White House as well, in terms of perhaps taking another bite at this apple. So we'll see. We don't know what exactly is going to happen there. Brian Riley, if you were making the case, let's say, to a skeptical lawmaker, give us your best argument.
The case that's typically been made for trade promotion authority is this is how we get an agreement. All we want to do is empower the president to negotiate an agreement. Then at the end of the day, take a look at the agreement. If it's good, vote it up. If it's not good, vote it down. And the argument has been, if you don't have trade promotion authority, you might never get that agreement in the first place. So don't pay attention too much to either the horror stories or mm-hmm. the wildly optimistic claims. But I think the case for trade promotion authority has typically been, let's stay engaged, let's try and get an agreement. Although there's been a lot of debate over exactly what the trade promotion authority bill itself should say and what kind of parameters should go into that. Now, President Obama has a real challenge trying to get members of his party on board. And one of the issues, as he tries to bring Democrats back on board, he's going to risk losing Republican support that mm-hmm. he needs to get this passed. So I wouldn't want to bet on how this is going to end up, but I don't see an easy path to getting this approved.
Sarah Anderson, I'll ask for your thoughts sort of from the counter perspective. But Brian Riley, I'm curious, are we really talking about, quote, free trade here? Because to hear both of you discuss these agreements, it sounds more like it's really about managed trade. Now, am I completely wrong on that?
Well, you're correct, and Sarah has a good point that these agreements do a lot more than just simply talk about tariffs. If we want to have a trade agreement and just say we're going to drop all our tariffs to zero, that would be pretty simple to do. But tariffs are already relatively low. Now, other countries have some restrictions on our products. We have some areas where tariffs are quite high. But one of the challenges is trade agreements have gotten broader and broader.
Mm.
And so you have the fear, on the one hand, that this is going to create, and this is something a Republican senator has said, TPP is going to be a Pacific version of the European Union. That's going to be a regulatory apparatus that's going to affect immigration and a bunch of things. And the U.S. Congress will have no say on anything in the future, which I think is a little exaggerated. And then on the other hand, you have the concern that, hey, this is just going to be protection for corporations. There's not going to be any regulations and Congress will have no say. And the truth is probably going to be someplace in the middle if they're able to get the agreement done.
Sarah Anderson, if you were speaking to a member of Congress who's on the fence about what to do in this case, what would your argument be?
I think what we're seeing in Congress is not just about trade. I think it is a reflection that the population has become more and more concerned about inequality, about rules being rigged in favor of large corporations and the top 1%. And so I think that a vote on this bill is going to be seen as a bit of a litmus test on which way are you standing on that whole big set of issues. I don't think you would have seen the thousands of groups come together to oppose this if it was just about the narrow content of the intellectual property rights chapter or whatnot. But I think people are seeing the symbolism here and wanting to chart a new path that really puts people and the planet first.
But if I'm understanding you correctly, also what has gotten pulled up into this is an experience over the last number of years where many Americans have begun to feel that their quality of life is stagnating, that opportunity is becoming less open for them, that this is kind of being pulled kind of almost viscerally into this debate.
Right. I mean, earlier, I think Brian might have talked about how we might get cheaper shoes and TVs out of this kind of agreement. I think people would prefer to have high-paying jobs, bringing back the high standards that a lot of the unionized jobs had that we've lost over the years. And people see these trade agreements as a big part of that hollowing out of the good middle-class jobs with decent pensions that we used to have. And they would prefer to bring that back than to get some of the benefits of trade in terms of these narrow, you know, lower consumer prices.
As we wrap our discussion here, I don't know if either of your organizations have taken a stand on the TPP, but for each of you, and first to you, Brian Riley, I'm curious, do you think, from what you know and what you've read about the debate and this agreement, do you think in general that this is something that should be supported? And if it is, that you have some confidence that this would actually improve the standard of living in the United States?
Well, I think that our previous trade deals have been good for the United States, whether it's the most recent U.S.-Korea Free Trade Agreement, the World Trade Organization. Those are things that have brought down barriers to trade and brought down barriers that separate people in the United States from people in other countries. And those increases in freedom have enabled economic growth in the United States. They show when we trade more, we lose some jobs, but we gain other jobs. When younger people are polled about free trade, they tend to be the most supportive. And I think understanding that, look, this isn't 1950. We're in a new century, and we need to make the most of our opportunities in the global economy.
Sarah Anderson, is this an agreement that you feel could help take the United States and its citizens, you know, into this new century and improve our overall standard of living and economy?
No, I don't think it would. And I don't want to limit my remarks to how I think it would affect the United States. I think it's a bad deal for ordinary people and the environment all around the world. And we need a different approach. This one puts large corporations above everything else. And we need to reverse those priorities.
It's going to be very interesting to see how this plays out in the coming weeks. I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there for today. I want to thank our guests so much for coming in and joining us today. Sarah Anderson, director of the Global Economy Project at the D.C.-based Institute for Policy Studies, and also Brian Riley, the J. Van Andel Senior Policy Analyst in Trade Policy at the Heritage Foundation's Center for Trade and Economics. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Encounter was produced this week at VOA's Broadcast Center in Washington. Thanks to our producer, Anya Zalewski, and our engineer, Rob McLean. Now, we'd love to hear your thoughts on today's topic. Do you think the TPP is a good deal? You can send us your thoughts via email, encounter@voanews.com. Let us know where you hear us as well. Carol Castiel is back again next week. Hope you'll be with us then for another edition of Encounter.